Let me first start by acknowledging that I come with a crew of people behind me, although they are invisible today. These are faculty members from Villanova University College of Nursing. I describe them as my team of champions, and I'll talk about that a little bit as we go. This project has been supported in part with a grant from the Association of Standardized Patient Educators and an Inglis Foundation ACE Award. I have no relationships to or conflicts to disclose. What I'm going to try to do is to describe the rationale, the process, and the challenges in integrating disability-related concepts in health professions education with an emphasis on nursing education, particularly at the undergraduate level, and also to identify some approaches to integrating these concepts while minimizing disruption to existing health professions curricula. And that has been my mantra all the way through this, doing this without disrupting existing curricula, because I know, and everybody in this room knows, that if you say to somebody, we're going to add something to your curriculum, or we're going to modify your curriculum, you're dead in the water. And so that was key to what we have, I think, accomplished. So one of the things I'm going to very quickly mention is why, actually I don't need to mention this because we just heard it, why we need to address disability concepts in healthcare professions education. But I'm going to do it anyway, at least very quickly. Some of the common research findings across disciplines is that people with disabilities receive less health care and care that is of lower quality than that for people without disabilities. People have, in fact, been reported being refused care. Healthcare sites, including such things as clinics, imaging centers, offices, etc., continue to be inaccessible despite the 25th anniversary of the ADA. People with disabilities are said to have a thinner margin of safety or health than those without disabilities, and negative encounters with healthcare providers result in not seeking care until or unless absolutely necessary, and inadequate and low-quality care often result. The effects of the absence of disability concepts in healthcare professions education across the disciplines has some very negative outcomes, as we've heard, including myths and inaccurate beliefs about people with disabilities, discrimination against people with disabilities, and low quality of care, or in some cases, no care, and negative attitudes. One of the things which is so striking to me, and I may have to add something to my list after hearing one of the presenters, these are the calls for addressing disability in healthcare professions education. Two U.S. Surgeon General reports, one IOM report, one National Council on Disability report, one World Health report on disability, and one Affordable Care Act. All of them have called for strategies to improve the knowledge, skills, and attitudes of healthcare providers to in turn improve the healthcare of people with disabilities. Generally, healthcare professional educations have not responded adequately to these calls for action, and that certainly includes nursing. One of the things which is very interesting, and I'm embarrassed to have to say this, but I did not look at the ICN or the International Council of Nurses document until relatively recently, I'd say 5 years ago, and I was stunned by what I found. In 2000, the ICN published a paper on the prevention of disability in the care of people with disabilities, and it says it all. It says exactly what nurses and other healthcare professionals should be doing. And I've been doing disability stuff for, you know, 20, 25 years, and I did not look for this statement. And so other people are probably unaware of it as well. It defines disability, identifies the fact that the ICN supports programs to designed to integrate people with disabilities in all aspects of daily life, in family, school, workplace, and community, indicates that nursing education should address competencies needed for the prevention of disability and the care and rehabilitation of people with disabilities, promote fuller understanding of the particular problems faced by people with disabilities, promote advocacy skills. Nurses' role is to assist, support, advocate for people with disabilities and their families to access education, information, and support services that allow them to lead fulfilling lives. Despite what I think is an incredibly clear statement about what nursing practice should be about, It does not happen. It simply does not happen. Currently, there is no accreditation or certification organization in nursing that has addressed disability or identified it as an important issue. No national nursing organization, education organization, or major nursing organization had, until very recently, and I'll tell you about that in just a minute, addressed disability as a relevant topic for nurses and for nursing education, despite the ICM statement. One of the things that occurred for me after, learning about the health issues of people with disabilities, many of the studies that have been done focus on physicians, and I was particularly interested in what about nurses. And so we conducted a study, I believe I reported on here at the APHA maybe a year or two ago. We did a qualitative study, and we found four themes. These themes are not going to surprise anybody in the room. Poor communication was the number one issue. People in the study reported that they were ignored by nursing staff. The nursing staff talked to whoever came with them. They didn't talk to them. They needed to explain and re-explain, what works and what doesn't work for them. They were treated as though they knew nothing about their own disabilities. People reported compromised care, unfortunately described the nursing care they got as lacking caring, compassion, understanding, patience, and respect. Negative attitudes, they felt as though they were seen as low priority, treated as children. They felt vulnerable. They were very fearful of being in the hospital. In this day and age, we should all be fearful about being in the hospital. But this group of people felt even more vulnerable in terms of hospital. And it was based on their previous experience. I mean, it wasn't just, I'm going to the hospital, that's a bad thing. It was usually based on their previous experience. So the concerns related to the quality of care led us to ask the question, well, what is being taught in nursing education about this topic? And so we conducted three studies. One was about the integration of disability content in undergraduate curricula. One was about content in nurse practitioner curricula. And then another one, the most tedious study on the face of the earth, was one in which we studied nursing textbooks very systematically to find out what is in those textbooks. What we found was that disability is largely invisible, which we've been hearing, in both the undergraduate and graduate levels and in textbooks used in nursing education. I am an author of a textbook. We could not review that for obvious reasons, which is a shame because it has disability content in it. Some faculty say they're teaching about disability, but their responses suggest otherwise. Some people reported that more important content has to be deleted, and disability isn't very important. Students are not tested on it by NCLEX, the licensure exam, therefore they don't teach it. And some faculty admitted or reported that they had never thought about the topic before, and the survey actually raised their level of awareness about it, which is interesting. We should send surveys, I guess. So we've done a couple of things. I'm going to save the undergraduate for just a second. At the master's level, we integrated disability content in the nurse practitioner curricula and developed a toolkit. We implemented standardized patients with disabilities in the nurse practitioner program, and this was done with funding from HRSA. On the undergraduate level, we have integrated standardized patients with disabilities throughout the undergraduate curriculum and are in the process of assessing the effects on students' attitudes toward people with disabilities with funding from the Association of Standardized Patient Educators. Our goals before doing this, because it's been my goal for a long period of time, to get the undergraduate faculty, and I admit I do not teach on the undergraduate faculty, and so I am sort of an interloper, and I'm saying to these people, you gotta teach about disability. And so that was a little bit difficult initially, until I got this team of champions on board, and they're doing the work for me in terms of making sure that other faculty buy this. So we wanted a smooth transition. We wanted to integrate disability across the curriculum, not in an isolated case here or there, but really throughout the curriculum. We did not want to reinvent or recreate the wheel. We had faculty that we had to satisfy. We needed to convince them that this is important to our students' learning. It's not something added to the existing curriculum, and we heard that a few minutes ago. It should be an integral part of the curriculum. So one of the things that we did was to integrate within the context of what we already do, and I'm going to show you that in just a second. And we had to convince faculty that this would not increase their workload. I'm seeing a couple of nods of heads there. The planning and the steps of the implementation were absolutely critical in order to get the buy-in from the course leaders and the course faculty. Communication among the project team and the faculty was absolutely key. We met with course faculty to share the plan, to get their feedback. Faculty wanted to understand how it would be integrated. They wanted to know what the outcomes were, and they also wanted to know if it was going to increase their workload. So that was an important issue. And we recruited and trained standardized patients with disabilities. Some logistical issues that we had to consider as we went forward, identifying and recruiting and training the people with disabilities to be standardized patients, financial issues, parking arrangements. Believe it or not, that is our worst nightmare, partly because we have a dean who has a handicapped parking sticker, and when the parking lot fills up with other people, you know, using that parking, doesn't go over particularly well, so we're working around that. Accessibility to the educational facility, which I'll tell you about in just a second, and issues related to the people with disabilities, fatigue, scheduling, unpredictability, and the effect of weather issues. And one of the things which is still an issue for me and for the rest of us is the sustainability of the project. I know this is not very visible, but I just want to sort of give you an idea about what we've done. The middle column is the original simulation that has existed for a long period of time in the simulation lab. So, for example, there was a communication scenario. I'm just picking a couple of these. There was no simulation in the area of the women and childbearing family course, and there was a simulation in the home care scenario, so we do send our students out. It's not an option, it's a requirement. So for the communication scenario, we had a scenario that specifically included a 25-year-old woman, standardized patient with a T7 spinal cord injury. It was important to have somebody who was close to the student's age so that they could identify with her. You know, if we had 80-year-old people with disabilities, they would, you know, I don't think they would get it quite as readily. We had added a standardized patient to the postpartum women's health, probably one of the most effective things that we did, and we added a person with an actual amputation to our home care scenario. The students were assigned to read Caring for Patients with Disabilities in the Smelter and Bayer Textbook of Medical Surgical Nursing, which we did not review for that one study. Following the debriefing, pre-briefing rather, students watched this communication video with this SP, and I'll just show you a couple of, not clips, but a couple of photographs from that just to give you an idea about what it was. And this was an in-class exercise, so it was in the classroom. And this, just to give you an example, the nurse addresses the mother as opposed to the young woman with a disability. Both the nurse and the mother are nursing faculty, and the woman in the forefront is the woman with spinal cord injury. Again, she's still talking to the student, or rather to the mother, and she's standing over her as opposed to sitting at eye level. And she dismissed the young woman's past history. She asked her a question if there was anything in her medical history that might be relevant, and the young woman started to say, well, I've had a lot of surgeries over my lifetime because of my injury, and the nurse said, that's not relevant, you're here for a sore throat. End of discussion. Those were the bad or inappropriate examples, followed by appropriate examples in terms of communicating. Sitting at eye level, asking how she could help, explains how the high-low table works, etc. The students had a freshman capstone interview. We also had a sophomore musculoskeletal assessment exercise, a couple of things related to that, and in the junior year, maternal postpartum assessment preparation for discharge, and then followed in the senior year by an experience with the person with an amputation. Some of the lessons learned from all of this are state-of-the-art 4-year-old building is not truly accessible. One of the things clearly one needs to do is to have people with disability assess the building, because the architects didn't quite get it. A team of champions is absolutely essential to make a program like this work. The individuals with disabilities are our best advocates. They have actually written and published an article about their experience. Sustainability remains a major issue because of the cost, and we're not talking about a huge cost, but it still remains an issue to our dean, who doesn't like the parking situation. Perseverance pays off. That's an important lesson, I think. The National League for Nursing, one of the two major nursing education organizations, has now, finally, adopted disability as a key aspect of its Advancing Care Excellence, or ACE, programs. So we are in the process of working with them on the new ACE-D, which is Advancing Care Excellence for People with Disabilities. This will be launched in the year 2016, and it will make content materials based on what we've developed, but modified specifically for the ACE program, so that they are available for faculty to teach nationally, to teach their students to provide quality care for people with disabilities. And there's our contact information.
Help me thank all four of our presenters today. Those are excellent presentations. Thank you so much. We're going to open the floor now for a question. If you can raise your hand, we have a mic that we would like for you to use. If you can please identify yourself with your name and the organization you're representing, and if you have a question for the panel or a specific speaker. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Megan Moore. We're going to work with Hoxha in Harvard Medical School. There is a researcher, her name is Michelle Van Ryan. She just completed a R01 where she followed 5,000 medical students throughout their 4 years of medical school, and she surveyed them throughout about their attitudes towards vulnerable populations. Unfortunately, she did not include disability, which she has now said is one of her great regrets for that study, but she looked at race and ethnicity and LGBT populations and attitudes towards obesity. And so she surveyed the students throughout the 4 years of medical school and had them take implicit association tests to measure implicit bias and explicit bias, and then also asked them about their exposure to cultural competency training. And what she found was that at the end of 4 years, what seemed to have the greatest effect, and unfortunately negative effect, on attitudes towards these populations, what is dubbed as the hidden curriculum. So they're in their internships, and negative comments are being made about certain populations. And that seemed to have the biggest effect. And actually, the number of hours that are exposed in cultural competency actually didn't change attitudes. So I was wondering if any of you would like to comment on, you know, how do we address this hidden curriculum? Because we can train them, but when they go out to their residency or onto the floor, how do we address that?
Who would like to start?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for that comment. That's much. And we've heard from other research that the trajectory of apathy for small medical students is quite high when I start medical school. They're really impassioned about helping patients. You know, take time if they have an opportunity to meet a patient one-on-one their first year, they'll sit down and spend as much time as they can with them, and they love that. And those empathy scores decrease. In the third year, when I first really exposed to that patients for a long period of time, and they continue to decrease the more they're exposed to the week of the hidden curriculum. And I think that it makes a lot of sense when we talked about how we teach professionalism. We are teaching a code of conduct in the role modeling that we do in medical school. Unfortunately, we're not good models. I think that we need to work with the faculty to make sure that they address their implicit biases and they're aware of the negative attitudes that they hold and the examples that they set.
I'm going to go with a really brutal answer to that question. The best way to do that would be to cut research funding by 75%. Medical schools, I've been at two of them, including your medical school, like research. They have a bias to research. They think research is cool. A lot of academic faculty, if you talk to them and you tie them down in their lab, will say that they'd really rather be doing research than seeing patients. That is a very frightening thing to me. If you like doing research that much, then get a PhD, don't get an MD, and you know, that's what you should be doing. That is probably, and I'm not yet at the point of advocating for a cut in NIH funding, naturally, mostly because I know a lot of folks at NIH who'd be really mad at me if I did that. But that may be the best thing we can do to improve patient outcomes in our country.
Catherine?
I'd just like to add that in our experience, having that meeting of patients in non-medical settings, you know, having people go to homes, visit homes, and really actually have volunteer experiences, change their attitudes and beliefs about people with disabilities. And I think the other was that faculty training was critical and preceptor training, so that the culture was transparent. But we had experiences where the students challenged the doctors that they were working with, saying, give this patient more time. Challenge the language. And when you start to see that changes, that really impacts the culture, saying, you really can't say that. So we don't have that going on across the board, but that really is what can change the way things are done.
Next question.
Hi, I'm Brian Altman, National Center for Disaster Medicine and Public Health, Rockville, Maryland. My question is for the presenter from Ohio State, and you raised an issue about some gender differences in your findings. And I wondered if you might be able to expand on the gender of the presenters who came and spoke with your students.
That's a great question. As I said, the prevalence of autism is much higher among males, so most of our volunteers with autism spectrum disorder were men, young men. We did have one woman, but the composition of the panels varied depending on who was available when. And so most of the time, the people with autism are male. Most of the time, the family members of kids and adults with autism were female. Although we did, in later years, we did make more of an effort to get fathers involved and siblings that were male and female, but in most cases, they were moms. Thank you for that question.
One comment, another question about idealism and compassion decline that seems to happen to medical students, is that there is an innovative project to change the way that third year medical education takes place called the Continuous Longitudinal Integrated Clerkships, CLIC, where instead of doing rotations 1 month at a time, you're assigned to preceptors, you know, at different days of the week, so you follow things for a more continuous time for 9 months. And that needs to introduce you to patients and get you more into their stories. And that's been actually demonstrated to not have the decline that said with all these measures of idealism with medical students. I could give more information if you are interested afterwards. And that's a strategy that's from UNC and Harvard. But I had a question for Dr. Capella. Question I had was, you talked about rights. Disability rights do you think is most important to convey to medical students and practitioners?
Well, first, I'm not a doctor, but I'm a real frontline educator. So most times we really want to make sure that it's practical, because otherwise, again, I think laws and rights start to become fearful, so they end up becoming compliant, where it really is an issue of access and equity. So that if a patient comes in and you have some difficulty with communication, you have to figure out how am I going to have communication. And I told this story yesterday about a deaf patient who I was their friend. So I went to the doctor's appointment. There were two interpreters. There was a doctor and a nurse practitioner. And I had a conversation with her where I had told her I smoked cigarettes many years ago. She goes,
I smoked once many years ago and I didn't like it. Well, the question, she had some challenges with her lungs, and the question came up, have you ever smoked? And she said, yes. But there was no follow-up question. I said, children smoked one, one cigarette 20 years ago. And it's the perception that if she had said yes, our healthcare system has a bias for those who smoke cigarettes. They deserve, you know, just sort of deserve what they get with you know, they made a mistake. Where it would have changed the nature of her care if they thought that she had cigarettes. The second was the doctor said, well, you know, you're working on maintenance, you know, you've got to stay away from the households. I'm sure you're just working for, you know, just for the sort of the fun of it, that you're just trying to get out. That there was an assumption that people with disabilities have money. So there's a lot more than just bias. And those interactions have to be discussed in a college setting. They have, there's a lot of perceptions that people with disabilities actually use a lot of services, have a lot of resources. And we make a lot of biases, especially for people with sensory deficits. There's a perception that they're all tied to agencies. That there's really, it's been really an eye-opener. And I think that the more we get scenarios, the more we get stories, the more we have actual opportunities for the students to disclose their fears, myths, and biases. That's what we're learning in this project. Then they start to find another way. And the preceptors, I think, are key, the mentors. And what we learned very early on was faculty openly admitted that they were not prepared to teach this curriculum. They didn't know anything about the ADA, nothing about bias. But I hope that answers your question. It has to become real. There's a lot of perception of compliance, HIPAA, all of our laws, but it's got to be practical.
Over here.
Yeah, hi. Putting aside the human and the moral issues here, this lack of education and sensitivity is also going to be costing the public taxpayer a whole lot of money. And I'm just wondering whether the managed care companies, who are very conscious of the bottom line here, have done anything to support additional education, or they're just taking what comes out of the mill, but do they play a role at all? It's certainly in their interest that providers be a whole lot more sensitive to these issues.
Let me grab that first,
yeah,
and others can. So the short end of the story is Medicare, who even benefits even more than managed care companies do, hasn't been able to do a whole lot because of pressure from Harvard and Yale and a lot of universities like that not to shift funding away from residencies that focus on specialized medicine toward primary care and community-based medicine. And as it stands now in the US, insurance cannot bill for preventative medicine. There is no way for you to reward a healthcare system for, you know, preventing things except for this rehospitalization tag that they have in the Affordable Care Act. It's not easy to figure out how you would do that without a true nationalized healthcare system, where effectively then they bill themselves when they fail. And so all the pressure is to not fail in keeping patients out of the clinic. But since providers benefit when patients are sick or perceived to be sick, all I need to do is ask you to look at the subway as you come home, to the airport or whatever, and look at all the health advertising that there is here in Chicago, to see that people benefit, providers benefit when people think they're sick. Insurance companies have to pay to make sure that people who think they're sick, whether they are or not, get the coverage that they want. So, you know, market-based solutions in this area, everybody's going to demand a Lincoln, when we really probably only all need Tauruses most of the time, and the Taurus is probably going to break less often too than the Lincoln will.
I think that's a great question. When the Affordable Care Act first came out, I was learning about some of the qualities and implications. I was really excited because I thought that the shift to promoting health and preventing illness would really reflect in a change in medical education.
that we would have more focus on compassionate care, and would we encourage aspiring physicians to go into primary care, because clearly we were going to need a lot more primary care providers. And I've been disappointed that that hasn't happened at all. We talk about medical educators, they really don't encourage their students to go into primary care because they'll be poorly compensated. And they recognize that students come out of school with a lot of debt, and if they're able to go into a subspecialty and make 40 times the salary, they feel disingenuous and urgent to do anything other than that. And so, I don't know what the letter is. I'm hoping to improve. I think the most powerful driver in medical education is the Association of American Medical Colleges. They're the ones who tell the medical schools what to teach. And more importantly, they write the board exams that students have to pass to become a physician. And whatever gets on the board exam will be taught. The medical schools are really invested in making sure students succeed in their career. And so I think that intervening there may have most promise, at least from
us. I would like to add that as I think an important step also in nursing, the fact that not suddenly, because it took a long time to make it happen, but we now have at least one major nursing education organization that has finally adopted that as an issue, that they think is worth pursuing. But we need to do it in licensure, we need to do it in certification as well. We need to make that a requirement. And the quote from the one study is, it's not taught, it's not tested, therefore I don't teach it. I think it says it all.
I would just like to add, I see the future in being one of patients' rights coming to really be a voice of patients saying, I want the best. I demand the best. And I think that is happening with seniors, and I think there's a real tipping point. And when I think in terms of 135 million people, I was thinking we were going to be there with 56, but people want help. I see the health and wellness as being really a quest now. So for people with disabilities, recognizing that we don't want disabilities to equal illness. The more we change the language that we use, the more we really reflect on in terms of making sure that culture of our schools are one of empathy and really recognition of evidence-based practices, we will end up having the insurance companies, I think, doing just what they do with seniors, incentivizing good health care. And I think there is some effort there with good practices. So maybe it won't be necessarily just the primary care doctor, but it will be the nurse practitioner who meets the patient. That it's an interprofessional system of care that I think will start to make people, especially the doctors, realize they don't have to know it all, and they can be more confident that they're. We did a little survey done by some pediatricians down on Long Island, and they identified their office manager is the key person to make sure that they had patient satisfaction. So we need to broaden our educational system to include all of the partners. And I think that could actually help improve our costs and quality of care.
I need to pause us here. Unfortunately, we are at time, and I know this is a topic that would stimulate great conversation because obviously strengthening the healthcare and public health workforce as we look ahead to improving the lives of people with disabilities is so important. So if you have a question and didn't have a chance to ask it, please come up. I think our presenters will stay for a minute or two. Otherwise, if we can thank them one more time, we really appreciate your comments today. Thank you so much.